Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The case of Michael Morton is a story that would be any man's nightmare. Your wife is murdered. You're accused and convicted of the crime. You spend nearly 25 years in prison. Released when it's learned that evidence that could have acquitted you was known by the prosecutors but not shared with the defense. How could you have coped yourself with these events? Morton has written a memoir of his experience entitled Getting Life, an innocent man's 25-year journey from prison to peace. Michael Morton, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question for Michael Morton, give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. You could email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org, or you can go to the comments section on our website at tpr.org. So Michael, tell me about the double meaning of your title of your book, Getting Life. What do you mean by that?
Well, obviously the first thing was the life sentence, but as happens to some people who go through long prison sentences, you're transformed one way or the other. And I was impacted by living in the penal world, but also on my release, I also got a new life. I went from one world to another world, and this new life I have is very different from my old life and the life before that. I mean, it has more than just two meanings.
Yeah. In the book, you give us the TikTok. You walk us through the narrative of what happened to you. But also at points in the book, you get very meditative and talk about that inner journey as well. How do you want the reader to digest your book? I mean, you could rip through it in a day, or you could spend weeks on it.
Yeah, it depends if you move your lips or not when you read. No, just kidding. It's one of those books, I think, well, what I shoot for anyway, is that there is that the physical story, the surface story, the what happened and when. But as with most of life's more profound experiences, things happen within, and the change that I went through, while it did happen to me and it was very important for me, what I would hope and pray that people who read this and learn about this will take away is that my experience could be transferred to other people's experience. I want them to learn that no matter what they're going through, if they're having financial problems or marital problems, medical problems, you name it, whatever you're going through, you can get through it. And even when you don't think you can, this is doable. I learned that I could do things that I didn't think I could do, and I could endure things that I didn't think I could endure. And at the end of that journey, at the end of the nightmare or ordeal or whatever it is, you can look back on it if you're lucky and if you try, and you will see that that trial you went through, that hard fight, has made you who you are. And if you're especially lucky, you can look back and see that, hard as it may sound, but you can look back and see that it's exactly what you needed. And that's a difficult truth for some people.
So you came home from work one day and your life took an incredible, difficult turn. Your wife had been brutally murdered, and then you were eventually accused and convicted of the crime. So first, I mean, I'm really sorry about the loss of your wife. And so how did you deal originally just with that?
The original, I guess I would say the news or learning of what happened, I would have to say that it's so outside, or it was so outside of my world experience, my personal experience, what I had expected life to be like, that sort of catastrophic news is akin to being punched in the face unexpectedly. You don't know what to expect. It's so beyond the pale. that I found what worked for me that I did by instinct instead of plan was that I began compartmentalizing my life. One thing I could probably handle, you know, trying to take care of my son. One thing I could probably handle, dealing with a murder investigation. One thing I could handle is probably dealing with my newfound lawyers. Altogether, they were debilitating and crushing and insurmountable. But individually, one simple chore at a time, and that's the way I got through it.
So you were a grocery store manager at the time, is that right?
I was a department head. I was working with a national grocery chain.
Okay. But so you were living like, you know, middle class life. And
very much so. Yes. My wife and I both had careers. We had our mortgage. We had a child. We were thinking of another. You know, we were living in suburbia. We were the statistical midpoint.
So we know that
eating the average.
Yeah, just the average guy, the average family, Jimmy Stewart type of a guy. And it seems just so that the killer, he just at random picked your house.
That's the way it seems. I've attended his trial and I've read all I can. I've talked to some people and I've been unable to, at this point anyway, actually communicate with him. But it appears to be random. I learned from at the trial that there may be some very sick psychological things going on in his head. There is another murder, Deborah Baker, that occurred about, I believe it was 17 months after my wife's murder. And when you compare my late wife and Deborah Baker and Mr. Norwood's ex-wife, they are all disturbingly similar in appearance. Children they had, the age and the number of children. I know with Deborah Baker and with my wife, Christine, they were all murdered on the same date, the 13th. And there's some very twisted things going on in that mind.
So you talk a lot about forgiveness. How do you feel about the killer?
I know that I will forgive him. I know that I must, because I have learned what a redemptive, cleansing, healthy thing that is. But in all candor, I have to admit to you or to anybody who asks that at this point in time, as of today, I'm not quite there yet with him. I know that'll come, and at some point I may take advantage of the Texas Penal Systems program for reconciliation. You can contact a prisoner or at least the system and see if he is willing to meet. I haven't gotten there yet, but I foresee that happening.
All right, Michael Morton, we're going to continue this conversation. If you want to join the conversation, we invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org .org or write directly on our show page on the website at tpr.org. This is The Source on KSTX. We will be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1987, a jury convicted Michael Morton of beating his wife to death. It took almost a quarter of a century to prove prosecutors hid evidence that could have cast doubt on Morton's guilt. And then years later, they refused to test a piece of evidence that turned out to be the smoking gun in the case that eventually set him free. The real killer, Mark Norwood, say that he went on to kill another woman after Morton's conviction. So not only did they convict a wrong person, but they didn't get the right guy and allowed him to stay free. Well, Michael Morton has written a book. It's called Getting Life, An Innocent Man's 25-Year Journey from Prison to Peace. And he's on the line now. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 210-614-8980. So the prosecutor had evidence, or at least things that they could have followed that may have shown that you didn't commit the crime. Were they just convinced, oh, the husband did it? Is that how it works, Michael?
I'm afraid so, or at least that's what I've learned from what's been revealed. Everybody, or many people, ask, is this a case of hubris or corruption or moral degeneration? And I'm not sure, because I haven't been able to get inside of anybody's head for those answers. All I have been able to review are the testimony of different people who were involved. We had a court of inquiry, and the prosecutor in my case, while I was in prison, became a judge, a district judge, and he had to testify, and so did a lot of the people involved. There were depositions, video, and text. And the answers just really weren't satisfying. The short answer, I think, is probably that our system is no better than the people in it. And we have to be involved citizens. We have to take notice of local elections, because all of the players were elected officials.
Well, we do have a new law, the Michael Morton Law, named for you, that requires prosecutors to turn over all of this evidence to the defense attorneys to try and prevent another Michael Morton from happening. So improve the system. That's their solution.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I had quite a bit of help, and I lobbied a great deal for that law. It's a good thing. We already have a case called Brady versus Maryland that requires these things, but just that requirement sometimes isn't enough, because we're dealing with human beings. And SB 1611, otherwise known as the Michael Morton Act, gives teeth to that and requires prosecutors to do this. And it's not just before the trial, it's during the trial and after the trial. And it makes the prosecutor liable if he fails to do this. And I can't imagine any thinking prosecutor jeopardizing his law license and his career just on an iffy case that he's not real sure of. So this is a good thing.
Some people wonder if the law maybe is a little bit too tough, and that it makes it easier for defense attorneys to get their clients off.
Well, that can be the argument if you think that more information being shared by both sides is a bad thing. If it gets you off of from a charge, if the accused is found not guilty because of this, well, that's only because police reports are made public are made available to the defendant. If any citizen is charged with a crime by the state, aren't they supposed to see the evidence brought against them? Before the Michael Morton Act, the prosecutors were the gatekeepers of information. They would decide what the defense or what the citizen would receive as far as information. And that's just not a balanced system. That's not a fair system.
Now, back to what happened to you. So you get indicted and you go to trial. When you were standing there waiting for the jury to deliver their verdict, did you think they would say not guilty or guilty?
I was expecting a not guilty verdict. I wasn't seeing things the same way the jury did. In my mind, everything had been an emotional plea. There were a lot of tears and shouting and fist pounding. But the hard evidence, the things like time of death and the other issues used to convict me, were all refuted. They were all in debate. They would bring forth an expert. We would bring forth an expert. And so when the guilty verdict came, I was surprised, and it had a physical impact on me. I collapsed into my chair. I lost my footing. It was literally a physical blow.
And during the trial, they accused you of being a sexual deviant and that you cried at all the wrong times and you were faking all of your emotions. I mean, to me, I always wonder about that. So how is a person supposed to react to an instance like this? And how, was there a script to follow? And whenever I hear someone accusing someone of not reacting properly, it weakens their case.
Yeah, and unfortunately, with the jury system we have, things that are said in court don't have to necessarily be true. They just have to resonate. And with the jury system, it's more of like a show. You're trying to sway 12 people that may not be real informed or experienced or on the ball for what's going on. Sometimes you're taking technical medical issues or technical legal points, and there are a lot of assumptions. I was, a few years before my wife was killed, I was actually on a felony jury, and everybody likes to think they would like a jury of their peers, but you never know who's going to get caught up in that net for jury duty.
Right. Talking to Michael Morton, he's written the book Getting Life, An Innocent Man's 25 Years Journey from Prison to Peace. He was falsely convicted of murdering his wife, and he spent a quarter of a century in prison here in Texas. There's a new law that is named for him, which requires prosecutors to turn over all evidence to the defense attorney to try and prevent more prosecutorial misconduct. So, Michael, how are you doing today? How are you putting a new life together?
I am very, very good. I've remarried. I have a new home, a new life. One of the things that kept me going for a while was I've tried to do my best to see that what happened to me doesn't happen to anyone else. And getting the Michael Morton Act passed, and I did not have anything to do with naming it, by the way, but getting that law passed was a big relief, and it was also much quicker than I expected. We got through both the Texas House and the Texas Senate unanimously. Not a single legislator voted against it, and the governor brought it up, and it was the first bill he signed in that session. But that's kind of like the professional side of one's life or the occupational side. On a personal note, I'm a different man than I used to be. And because of all that I've been through, I find myself incredibly sensitive to the little pleasures of life that everybody should experience. I take great joy in things like, sunsets or the sound of a rainstorm. I love the way the birds wake up in the morning and start chirping. Child's laughter or somebody's pet.
Yeah, you write in a book about looking out the window and just trying to get a glimpse of birds, or if you're lucky, they would build a nest outside of your window or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was it's funny. That's kind of got started when I was in penitentiary. It's such a bleak world of concrete and steel that while I was in the prison in the Huntsville area, we would watch birds make their nests. And there's something almost therapeutic about nature.
All right. I'm going to get a caller in on the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. Andrew was called in. Andrew, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, David. First, Mr. Morton, I'd like to congratulate you on your recent success on getting everything that you was taken away from you. And second, I want to ask if there are still people out there, after all this evidence that has come forward, if they still think you are guilty.
Thanks for the question, Andrew. So, Michael?
I don't think so. The vast majority of people see the truth. I think there may be a couple folks that are in Williamson County that may be very slow to come around. But I have to say that the people of Williamson County have been incredibly gracious to me. When I go back to Georgetown, which is the county seat, it's not unusual for people to burst out of restaurants and run out and shake my hand as I walked on the sidewalk, or I've even had them pick up my check at restaurants there. The citizens of Georgetown have been very, very kind to me.
But that's not always been the case. When you were the suspect, people treated you a lot differently.
Yeah, I went from being a murderous perv and the boogeyman into being somebody that it's very unusual, but in the public realm, I'm almost universally loved. It's a very unusual transformation.
But it's interesting how people can just suddenly go from one thing to the next thing. They hear that you may have murdered your wife, and they all have this feelings for you, very strong, and then now, no. It's to be examined.
Yeah, that phrase, rush to judgment, is apt. We think we see something in the media, and there's almost a bit of psychological shorthand that helps us or pushes us into making conclusions we shouldn't necessarily make.
So let us examine our own, logic in those cases. Michael Morton, thank you so much. His book is Getting Life, An Innocent Man's 25-Year Journey from Prison to Peace, a memoir, a fascinating book. Michael Morton, congratulations, and again, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davies. This has been wonderful.
This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.